Israel and Hamas exchanged hostages on the sixth day of the ceasefire that is set to end on Thursday unless an agreement to extend it is reached.
10 Israeli women in exchange for another 30 Palestinian prisoners.
Plus, Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Israel Wednesday.
Blinken returns to the Middle East for talks Thursday and Friday, the third time since the militant group Hamas triggered the war with its October 7th attack on Israel.
And former First Lady Rosalynn Carter is laid to rest near her home in Plains, Georgia. Today is Thursday, November 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Israel and Hamas exchanged hostages Wednesday on day 6 of the humanitarian aid ceasefire, which is set to end Thursday unless agreement to end it is reached. Israel is also investigating a statement from Hamas that members of the Bibas family, a 10-month-old baby, a 4-year-old youngster, and their mother have been killed. I spoke with Linda Gradstein, VOA's Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, who tells us more.
The Israeli army says that they're checking the information. They have not confirmed it. Apparently, the family was handed over to another group in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza after they were captured. They were certainly captured alive, but if it turns out that it is confirmed and it is true, it's going to be very sad for a lot of Israelis. Somehow these two little red-haired children have become the symbol of all of the hostages, and the fact that they weren't on any of the other groups who were released means that it's certainly possible that they have been killed.
As you mentioned, Linda, since the baby and family who've been held hostage have become iconic symbols of those captured by Hamas, how do you think this might affect Israel's focus on the war, considering outrage from its citizens?
Israelis, I think, are willing to do quite a lot to get the hostages released. And the fact that Israel has already agreed to extend the truce by 2 days, now there are negotiations to extend it for a further 4 days. There are negotiations going on. And I think Israelis will be very angry and will be frustrated. At the same time, I think it will even make their resolve to get as many hostages as possible back. Although at the same time today, we heard Prime Minister Netanyahu vowing that as soon as the ceasefire ends, whenever that is, Israel will go back to attacking Hamas, and that this is not a ceasefire, this is a temporary humanitarian pause.
Speaking of prisoner hostage release, Wednesday was the sixth day of the exchange between Israel and Hamas. Can you fill us in on this latest exchange?
10 Israeli women in exchange for another 30 Palestinian prisoners. On the list of Palestinian prisoners, by the way, is a young woman named Ahed Tamimi, who's become sort of a symbol of a lot of Palestinian prisoners. And then the question is what's going to happen now, whether there will be a further extension of the ceasefire. And also on the table is what's called an all-for-all deal, in which Hamas would release all of the hostages, at least that it says it has control over. There are still 9 children missing and an unknown number that Hamas says it doesn't have control over. And in exchange for those, I don't know, something like, the numbers are a little bit fuzzy here, 130 hostages, Israel would be asked to release all of the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. There are over 5,000 prisoners, and that's going to be a much harder decision for Israel to make.
Finally, back to the war itself, I understand that Israel conducted a raid on the Jenin complex?
Yes, the Jenin refugee camp has always been known as one of Hamas's strongholds in the West Bank, and it's also been one of the flashpoints in fighting between Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank. Israel conducted a raid on Jenin. It said it was looking to arrest members of Hamas that it believed were there. This has been happening actually almost daily. And at the same time that Israel's been fighting a war with Gaza, the West Bank has been heating up. And in fact, Israeli officials say the Palestinian Authority has been doing a lot to try to make sure that there are not terrorist attacks on Israelis. But there are a lot of soldiers in the West Bank. There are a lot of Jewish settlers with guns. There's a lot of tension. And Israel says it will continue to arrest anyone who is affiliated with Hamas or who attacks Israeli soldiers.
That was Linda Gradstein, VOA. VOA's Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem. At the time of this recording, the two sides had not reached agreement on extending the ceasefire. Israeli military officials say if agreement is not reached, fighting will resume Thursday at 7 a.m. local time in Israel. Antony Blinken arrived in Israel Wednesday, where he says he will work to prolong a pause in the fighting so that more hostages can be released and more humanitarian aid can be delivered to Gaza. Blinken lands in the Middle East following meetings with his NATO counterparts in Brussels, where he reassured allies of continued U.S. support for Ukraine. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent, Cindy Sain, reports.
Russia's defense ministry released video Wednesday. It says shows Russian fighter jets and artillery firing at Ukrainian targets. Russian forces have ramped up attacks on eastern Ukraine as the winter approaches. In Brussels, at a NATO foreign ministers meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken acknowledged that some have questioned whether the U.S. and other NATO allies should continue to stand with Ukraine almost 2 years after Russia's full-scale invasion.
But the answer here today at NATO is clear and it's unwavering. We must and we will continue to support Ukraine.
Blinken sought to reassure allies concerned that some Republican lawmakers in the U.S. Congress are reluctant to keep funding robust military aid for Ukraine. He said Speaker of the House Mike Johnson had spoken about the need to fund Kyiv recently, which Blinken called encouraging. One analyst told VOA additional funding for Ukraine is not in Blinken's hands. Michael Kimmage is a professor of history with the Catholic University of America. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
There's not a great deal that Secretary Blinken from the executive branch can do about that. It's really in the hands of the legislature, a co-equal branch of government, and the Republican Party is sort of ironing out its differences, or not ironing out its differences as we speak.
Kimmage told VOA that Blinken is sending a strong message by attending meetings of NATO and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, during the Israel-Hamas war.
And there is a kind of allegation out there, or a claim out there, that the U.S. Has now shifted attention to the Middle East and is doing less to engage with Europe. I think that Secretary Blinken, in going both to the NATO and the OSCE meetings, is very firmly trying to signal that the U.S. remains focused on Europe.
Blinken returns to the Middle East for talks Thursday and Friday, the third time since the militant group Hamas triggered the war with its October 7th attack on Israel. Blinken said he would work to prolong the truce so more Israeli hostages can be released and more humanitarian aid can be delivered to Palestinian civilians in Gaza who desperately need it. Blinken plans to visit Israel, Ramallah in the West Bank, and the United Arab Emirates. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
One of Mexico City's most historic churches has become one of the epicenters of the migrant crisis facing the country, with more than 1,000 migrants using it as a staging point on their way north to the United States. Reuters' Gabe Singer has the story.
As an influx of migrants passes through Mexico on their way north to the United States, some have found a temporary home at this church in Mexico City. This migrant tent city began to form around 2 months ago. Now, the Church of Solitude hosts more than 1,000 people on its grounds. Most are from Venezuela, Haiti, and other Latin American countries. Many bring with them painful memories from the road.
We have endured rain. We have endured problems. Children have been kidnapped. Women have been raped. We're in the wild.
Those that land here try to create some semblance of a normal life. Children play between the tents, and families gather for meals around open fires. You can even find a haircut or a pedicure. Some of these migrants are waiting for an appointment with U.S. Customs and Border Protection, or CBP. Others say they will take the train north, a euphemism for entering the U.S. illegally. The 17th century church is in a tough neighborhood, prone to crime. By day, it hosts regular services. But at 6 o'clock, as the sun sets, the pews are stacked away, and hundreds of mattresses are laid on the cold marble floors. Migrants are ushered in, given a meal, and a safe place to sleep. Father Benito is a priest at Solitude.
We have hosted up to 1,300 migrants. The numbers fluctuate. Thank God we have around 600 or 700 people, but this is volatile. Some days, the number goes up. Outside the church, there are people who have been waiting for over 15 days to get the CBP appointment. They have set up tents. The ones who enter the church get accommodation for 3 to 5 days. Some are allowed to stay for longer.
Some migrants report even longer wait times for an appointment, up to several months in some cases. Against these difficult circumstances, migrants turn to their community in the tent city as a source of strength.
Here we are one whole family, fighting together. Haitians, Colombians, Chinese, Japanese, we are one family.
That was Reuters' Gabe Singer. We're also following these stories from around the world. 100-year-old Henry Kissinger, a controversial Nobel Peace Prize winner and diplomatic powerhouse whose service under two presidents left an indelible mark on U.S. foreign policy, died on Wednesday, according to Kissinger Associates Incorporated. An Indian government official directed an unsuccessful plot to assassinate a Sikh separatist who is also a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil, the U.S. Justice Department said on Wednesday in announcing charges against a man accused of orchestrating the attempted murder. The U.S. military says the USS Kearney, a U.S. Navy warship sailing near the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, shot down an Iranian-made drone launched from the Houthi-controlled area of Yemen. It is the latest in a string of threats from Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. Member countries are divided over the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's annual foreign ministers meeting on Thursday, with Baltic nations and Ukraine refusing to attend over the presence of Russia's Sergei Lavrov. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Sudanese women of various backgrounds recently gathered in Nairobi to discuss the brutal war that has ravaged their country the past 7 months. With no end in sight, they feel their voices have been silenced, and they yearn to contribute to resolving the conflict that has killed thousands and displaced millions since April 15th. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo was there and has this report.
Women in Sudan were a big part of a revolution that helped end 3 decades of autocratic rule by former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. Their push for a transition to a civilian government was cut short when war broke out 7 months ago between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary unit. Thousands are dead, millions are displaced, and there is no end in sight.
Since April 15, voices of civilians and voices of women has been completely, sabotaged. We didn't have a space to tell our story or to speak about our suffering.
Hala Al-Karib is with the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. She says her organization convened a 2-day summit in Nairobi because it's important to bring Sudanese women and civil society groups together.
We have participants who came from conflict zone and they have endured living under fire and exposed to all kinds of violence for the past 7 months. It's really critical to listen to their stories, to listen to their experience, and to listen to their positions and views.
Some participants spent 3 to 10 days on the road to reach Nairobi, including Nidal Usman Musa, who runs the South Khartoum Kandakat grassroots organization.
We have faced much obstacles, displacement, refugees, rape, violence. We missed our job. Our children missed their education, and also we missed our voice in this war.
Alawiya Bahr el-Din, a former social worker, now a refugee in neighboring Chad, had to leave her home of El Janina in West Darfur, where about 700 people were reportedly killed earlier this month after clashes between SAF and the RSF, according to the International Organization for Migration.
This is so difficult. The situation there is so difficult for women. Believe me.
The fighting in Sudan has made it hard to reach certain areas, says Nadal Fadul, who's with SUDRO, the Sustainable Development Response Organization. She's based in the United States. Fadul says it's imperative the women unite toward peace and how to sustain it so the reality on the ground doesn't happen again.
So we're talking about people with diabetes, for example, not able to get insulin to treat their diabetes. We're talking about kids with malaria not able to get anti-malaria treatments. We're talking about women not able to get simple menstrual hygiene products to be able to go through that with dignity.
Others participating in the conference as a show of support included the Netherlands chargé d'affaires to Sudan, Burish Ramsuk, now living in Nairobi, who said the challenge for these women is to develop a political strategy for getting a seat at the negotiating table.
There's an extra hurdle for women to be taken, and that is not only to formulate their vision, what they want for women in Sudan, but also to be heard. And I like the spirit this morning where it was said, you do not wait until you get invited, you just go, you take it.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nearly 200 countries will gather in Dubai beginning Thursday for this year's United Nations climate negotiations, known as COP28. VOA's Lori London spoke with Michael Gerard, professor of environmental law at Columbia University, about one of the implications of climate displacement, an issue with big global implications, but one of the most difficult for world leaders to find consensus.
The World Bank has estimated that by 2050, there will be 200 million climate refugees. We're seeing extreme heat worsening, flooding, weather events that are deadly and growing worse every year. There will be obviously issues that will make places potentially unlivable. What are the implications of that kind of massive number of climate refugees?
There's a huge disconnect between the number of people displaced by climate change that we're expecting and the policies of any government to deal with that. There's no legal structure to cope with people who are displaced by climate change. They are not technically considered refugees within international law. So countries don't have an obligation to take them in. There are negotiations about that, but they haven't gotten very far. So we're already seeing in the United States and Europe and other places tremendous resistance to people trying to get through the border. Large numbers of people trying to get in tends to lead to the strengthening of right-wing movements, and the people who can't get in are subject to enormous suffering. So there is very little good news to report on the front of climate displacement.
And is it already happening to some degree?
Many of the people who are coming in from Latin America are coming in because of persistent drought and agricultural failures. You know, it's the drug wars get most of the attention, but a lot of it is worsened by climate change. The Syrian civil war was worsened by climate change. A lot of people coming up from Africa. So yes, this is already happening to a certain extent. It's a profound injustice that the countries that are suffering the most from climate change contribute the least. The countries that seem most vulnerable in terms of the sheer number of people to be affected are Bangladesh, and Pakistan, some countries in Africa, some countries in Latin America, and of course the small island Pacific states. We have widespread vulnerability in lots of different parts of the world, but I think those are the areas that are the most vulnerable.
What sorts of things will make their habitats unlivable?
Sea level rise is certainly going to have one major impact. Drought. Parts of Africa, the Sahel region, have suffered persistent drought, and if it's not possible to grow food, lack of water is going to be another impact. And in the years to come, there are increasingly distressing projections about extreme heat. Already we've had unprecedented heat waves, especially during what should be the winter in the southern hemisphere and in other parts of the world. So there will come a time when some parts of the world are literally uninhabitable for periods of time unless you have air conditioning. And a lot of these places don't have much air conditioning. So that could be another driver of large-scale migration.
And you mentioned conflict and unrest. Would forced migration due to climate change, could that potentially be leading to further conflict that we're already seeing so many of around the world, or could it exacerbate those that are already happening?
Climate change is seen as a threat multiplier, that where you have political instability, it makes it worse. That has certainly happened in places like Sudan, Syria, and other places in the world. It puts more people on the move. It puts greater pressure on public services, on food supply. It makes people angry. There are many different mechanisms mechanisms, but yes, it makes the situation worse. If you have people who are forcibly displaced from their homes and there's no habitable place for them to go, that leads to a very serious situation. People are not going to quietly let their children starve. They're going to want to move to a place that is at least survivable and even better than that. Many of the places they would want to go don't want to let them in. And that is really a recipe for real conflict.
That was VOA's Lori London speaking with Michael Gerard, professor of environmental law at Columbia University. With her frail husband as a silent witness, Rosalind Carter was celebrated by her family and closest friends on Wednesday for her funeral in Plains, Georgia, the same tiny town where she and Jimmy Carter were born. The services were a rare gathering of presidents and first ladies who came together to honor Rosalind Carter, but several speakers at her tribute service said that crowd was not indicative of what defined her. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
She had met kings and queens.
Sun Chip said she was, of course, around presidents, others in power, but she was most comfortable with the vulnerable, people who needed help.
Those that lived in absolute abject poverty.
Grandson Jason called her down to earth, remembering a Delta flight where she pulled out a Tupperware of pimento cheese and a loaf of bread.
And she just started making sandwiches. People were sitting there like, Rosalind Carter just made me this sandwich, you know? And they couldn't believe it.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For peace to reign, all people must share equally in the benefits of development. Indeed, building sustainable peace requires the harmonization of numerous issues, including economic development, quality of life, human rights and dignity, trust in government, and the rejection of violence as a means to an end. When all people in a country are not able to enjoy the benefits of development equally, or when they cannot exercise their fundamental human rights, the risk of violent conflict increases, said United States Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield. Proactivity is necessary because we have seen how difficult it is to take action after conflict has already broken out. For instance, global food insecurity. We know that conflict is the number one cause of hunger, but we also know that hunger is a driving force of conflict. It is our job to disrupt that cycle.
In 2022, the United States was proud to provide over half of World Food Program's budget. But more than just responding to current famines, we need to work collaboratively to prevent future ones. Whether it's helping develop climate-smart crops and agricultural practices, or helping family farmers secure equal access to land, knowledge, and financial support.
According to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, developing countries are up against a perfect storm of crises, including enormous debts, constraints on government finances, and ability to choose where to allocate funds, and soaring inflation. As the world's major economies mobilize financing for development, it is imperative that we prevent rather than contribute to unsustainable debt and even debt distress, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
The United States has been working with a broad coalition to evolve the multilateral development banks and to expand by hundreds of billions of dollars the availability of safe, sustainable financing, especially for the poorest countries.
We need to identify instability, places where a lack of development and a lack of fundamental freedoms heightens the risk of conflict, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. As we mark the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we must make sure that sustainable development is grounded in the principles of this foundational document, one we are all a party to and that we must work to make reality for every single person so that we can finally realize the vision of a world without conflict. Our children and our grandchildren's future depend on this.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.